Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome Emily Nemens, author of the highly regarded debut novel, The Cactus League. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Emily Nemens' The Cactus League is set in the Arizona desert around Scottsdale during spring training for Major League Baseball. The novel is narrated by a sportscaster, and while nominally the story of Jason Goodyear, the star outfielder for the fictional Los Angeles Lions, Goodyear's story is interspersed with the stories of other richly drawn characters, the batting coach, the aging sports agent, the players, the owners, ballpark staff, and the hangers-on. Nemens' keen eye for detail brings to life a connected web of people behind a seemingly linear game. As the favorable New York Times review calls it, there are probably more good novels about baseball than any other sport. More bad ones, too. Emily Nemens' The Cactus League definitely belongs in that first lineup. Emily is the editor of the prestigious literary magazine, The Paris Review. She was previously co-editor of The Southern Review, and her work has been published in N Plus One, Esquire, and elsewhere. A graduate of Brown University with an MFA in creative writing from Louisiana State University, Emily is also an accomplished illustrator. Emily Nemens, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you, Bob. Thank you for having me.
Well, I have to say, Emily, it's a clever novelist who times her book about baseball with the cancellation of the baseball season, for now at least, knowing that baseball fans are going to jump out there to their bookstore. If they can't get there physically, of course, they'll order online and get a copy of your book. Not bad strategy.
No, you know, the book came out February 4th, and I was emphatic. FSG published it, and, you know, Literary Fiction, the editor-in-chief there is a British woman. You know, I said, guys, Pitchers and Catchers happens on Valentine's Day. We need it out the week before. And I think they thought I was speaking Greek, but, you know, they said, okay. I thought I had 6 weeks, really, for this book to be front and center. Little did I know that, you know, spring training was going to be the only baseball fans would have this year. And we're sort of suspended in time with the Cactus League.
Exactly. Well, I must tell you that I took your book to spring training this year.
Oh, fun. And,
yeah. And I got down there in early March. My wife and I always go to spring training and take in the Seattle Mariners. And the Cubs, my former team when I was in Chicago, I still root for the Cubs. And we decided after a week in Arizona in early March that it was probably time to cut a week off of our schedule and come home because of the coronavirus spread. And the day we left, left was the day they canceled and just left spring training and no Major League Baseball. So our timing was exquisite. Yours was not. But on the other hand, clearly for those of us who love baseball and thought we were going to be watching it about now, if not being at the ballpark, this book is just such a perfect way to get into the game. And when I say the game, it's not just the game, but you've done such a great job of covering the people around it. And I think the place I'd like to start, here you are, editor of the prestigious Paris Review, formerly associate editor of the Southern Review. If I had to guess what kind of book the editor of the Paris Review would write, it wouldn't be The Cactus League. And maybe you can share with our listeners something about your background and how baseball fits into your life.
Sure, absolutely. So I grew up in Seattle. I'm the daughter of a New York Yankees fan. My dad was a transplant from New York out in the late 70s. And I'm the younger of two girls, and my older sister had no interest in baseball. But I did. And it coincided with, you know, the appearance of Ken Griffey Jr. and Edgar Martinez and that really just remarkable dozen years of Mariners baseball landed right on top of my childhood, I'd say. Yeah. So my dad and I started going to games when I was 5 or 6. So I think it was just in my blood. It was second nature to go to the stadium. I kind of hate crowds, but, you know, once I'm in my seat, I am a happy clam and a very contented camper. And, you know, watching games in the kingdom growing up had its charms, but watching indoor baseball is kind of a bummer. And so, you know, in my preteens, my dad and I started traveling for a long weekend down to spring training. And, you know, the very visceral experience of being in the sun in a small stadium, watching these more intimate, more familiar games, when one, you've just come out of a Northwest winter. So there's just like an actual shock to the senses, but it's also this much more engaged game to be, you know, in a 10,000 seat stadium, very close to the players, so close you can hear them talking and bantering. You know, there's more chances for interaction watching them on the practice fields. Everyone's in the same place and it's a much smaller place. So that was a magic thing for me. And I didn't go every year, but we went, you know, on pretty regular occasions all through my teens. And then also, you know, I moved to the East Coast in 2001 for school and then for work. And Phoenix was still kind of in the middle for my dad and I. You know, we could both get direct flights there. So we continued the tradition. And, you know, it just was a fascinating thing. And I think the other thing that inspired the project in terms of my history, well, it's not my history, it's the history of American letters, right? Baseball novels are few and far between, but they are sort of an established subgenre of the American conversation. And they all are contingent on the bottom of the ninth, the end of the season, you know, the big game in the series. And I just felt like building a narrative around sort of the ninth inning and the end of the game had been done so well, but so many times. And as a writer, I was really excited in inverting that and exploring that and sort of disrupting that narrative and thinking about where else do the stories and where else does the drama lie in baseball. And so, mm-hmm. So those were the big motivating factors. And, you know, I appreciate your note that it's surprising that the editor of the Paris Review would write, you know, sort of an ode to baseball, but, you know, our founding editor, George Plimpton, sort of invented participatory journalism. And it was that's for goofy. Sure. It was a bit goofy that, you know, he talked his way into a Detroit Lions uniform and was able to quarterback a few plays. But I think, you know, George was doing it in a very different way, but understood this adjacency in the conversation between literature and professional or community sports, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the way we think about sports as a community driver, as a value in our culture, says a lot about us as a community and as a culture. And, you know, that's no different than any other motivation for why writers write, is to explore mm-hmm. what we value, how we express that, how we treat one another. Those feel universal and feel as literary as anything.
So the question that really fascinates me as I think about your book, I mean, it's one thing to go to games. I've been going to both major league and minor league games for a very, very long time, given my old age. And yet I couldn't write a novel like this. I mean, first of all, I would have no ability to write the novel the way you wrote it, the writing style, how beautifully written it is. But the details that you have in this novel, not just about the players. In fact, this isn't a novel about balls and strikes. This isn't a novel about foul balls or home runs. It's a novel about the people around the game and the players, their foibles, their wives, their girlfriends, their agents. Even the organ player gets into your book. How did you do some research? Did you pull some people aside, like somebody who sells popcorn or beer at the stadium, and say, tell me about your life? Or is this just the really good work of a novelist writing fiction? You make this up.
I made it up.
All right.
Mostly, you know, I did a lot of research, but I think the character development, and thank you for saying so many kind things about the characters of the book. I think, you know, I would almost call it deep research, that one of my first projects and a thing I have cared about for a long time is oral history. And thinking about storytelling and conducting oral histories, reading oral histories, editing oral histories, and the selflessness and the complete immersion that the editor, interviewer, reader experiences of just totally immersing oneself in someone else's life. So in that way, I felt really equipped and excited to put my narrative voice behind 9 different characters, the different characters in these different chapters. And it felt natural to write in that sort of multivocal mode in a way that I think only afterwards did I realize how strange that was, that not all writers are able to pivot between these different points of view and different perspectives. Of course, you know, getting each of those voices right took several years. I started this book in 2011. And, you know, in terms of the specificity of different characters, I would, you know, edge up towards something, realize I don't know enough about this, and then would go do a lot of research so that they had the authenticity they needed to carry the narrative. You know, but for instance, with the organist chapter, I had played jazz growing up. In fact, I would come to Idaho every year to go to the Lionel Hampton Festival.
Oh, yeah,
and
sure.
Yeah. And I wrote that whole organist chapter. And then I was at a party and encountered the organist for Fenway Park. And I cornered him and said, can I talk to you? I have a few questions. And we ended up sitting down for a meal later that weekend. And, you know, I said, I know this sounds crazy, but I have an organist in my book. And he's of a generation that played on the original instruments and is trying to deal with this updated technology and this, that, and the other, and sort of talk through several points in that chapter. And he said, yeah, you pretty much got it right. So it was mostly a novelist's imagination, but one who is very concerted and careful about checking her facts.
Right, right. You're listening to Emily Nemens, the author of The Cactus League. So you mentioned your interest in oral history. It reminds me of your narrator, who, if this was not a book, it would almost seem like this guy's the oral historian. And he injects himself into this book every few chapters and gives some really interesting history lessons, in part on the geology of the state, on mm-hmm. those who occupied the state years before white people showed up. I wonder, in the chief's words, I think at one point in the novel, the sports writer is asked the question, why the history lesson, chief? So tell us a little bit about the narrator, this middle-aged sports writer who's kind of, maybe he's over the hill, I don't know. But anyway, why the history and geology lesson?
Yeah, so the book opens, the first pages, but also the inciting incident, are a brand new stadium opening in Scottsdale, Arizona. And, you know, baseball stadiums are these monuments, man-made, monumental architecture, thinking about, you know, the achievement of building a new landmark. It's a milestone. But I wanted to have the narrator recognize that, but also recognize that, you know, it's a 10,000 person stadium, and this natural environment, you know, it's adjacent to a mountain range. And as much as we like to toot our own horns and celebrate recent achievements in architecture or other sorts of city building, this place is more than the buildings we've placed upon it. And just keeping sort of a gut check almost. And I thought the gut check coming from him, from, you know, forcibly retired journalist who has been chasing sort of the daily story his whole career, for him to recognize that, you know, our timeline and our news cycle aren't the only game in town, isn't the only game in town, felt a little bit, felt important that he was able at last to sort of put his own project in perspective and understand that, you know, while the salacious story of what's happening to the left fielder is something that he wants to pursue, and while the stadium being built maybe is a way for this community to come back from the recession is notable. Mm-hmm. It's still small beans. It's a drop in the mm-hmm. bucket. And that humility felt compelling.
Well, it was very well done. Let's talk about your protagonist, Jason Goodyear. First of all, I must say, in asking this question, I never read reviews of the books I'm going to talk to an author about. I just don't want to get into what other people thought of it. And so I didn't until last night, right before I finished my preparation for this conversation, I went in and checked out a couple of these reviews. And what was interesting is that when I read these books, I mark them up. And when I got to your description of Jason Goodyear, I put in the margin, Mike Trout. And when I read one of these reviews, one of these guys said, yeah, it's like Mike Trout. Now, obviously, Jason Goodyear has lots of problems that Mike Trout, I don't think, has. At least one major one. But why don't you tell us about your protagonist?
Yeah, so Jason Goodyear is a left fielder. He is a generational player. And in that way, he is like Mike Trout. He, you know, is a Gold Glove winner, an MVP, has a great arm, has a great bat. You know, obviously, growing up watching Griffey, I know how to describe a beautiful swing.
Right.
And a certain amount of acrobatics in the outfield. But Jason, you know, in developing his character, I was less interested in any specific athlete that exists currently or historically, and more interested in the dichotomy and the conflict of the expectations of athletes to have this sort of perfect veneer and their public personas being idealized and scrutinized, you know, and mm-hmm. for a lot of athletes, some athletes really are just boring, right? But for a lot of athletes to maintain that facade requires just a lot of protection and really siloing one's personal life and burying one's problems and projecting, you know, as flat a facade as possible. You know, I think Derek Jeter did a great job of that in terms of being publicly a very straightforward athlete who knows what's going on behind the surface and at home. And how do you manage both you as the athlete, but you as the agent, you as the front office, you as the manager, you as the Lions' biggest fan, manage when that veneer starts to crack? You know, and so without spoiling it, Jason is, you know, the Los Angeles Lions' biggest investment. He is, you know, has always had this perfect facade, and his public presentation and persona has just been, you know, very plain and very ideal. And that starts to crack across the course of the spring. And, you know, it's upsetting to him, but I was really interested in thinking about how it would be upsetting to other people as well. You know, because as fans, you know, we care about, you know, obviously I'm not, you know, married to anyone on the team. And so, of course, his wife might care about him more than me. But, you know, I think as fans, when someone on your team, when your favorite athlete goes down with an injury or is having a performance issue, even just a slump, that hurts everyone.
Sure does.
And I wanted to think about that ripple effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it's giving anything away to talk about what Jason Goodyear's main problem was outside of baseball, and that's a gambling addiction. And the reason I want to bring that up is because Pete Rose finds his way into your novel. And mm-hmm. so I guess I'm thinking, I wonder if Emily was thinking about Pete Rose and the fix he got himself into. And I wonder if Emily would take a question like, do you think this guy's paid his price and ought to be given an opportunity to get into the Hall of Fame?
Pete, I think he should. That being said, I think he's had a couple opportunities to redeem himself and hasn't played them right. But mm-hmm. I mean, I'd like to see him in the Hall of Fame.
And Jason, of course, like so many of these players, they do come with baggage. And did you choose the gambling addiction as opposed to a drinking or whatever? Were you thinking about Pete Rose when you put this thing together?
I mean, I was thinking about Pete Rose. I was thinking about Michael Jordan. I was thinking about all sorts of athletes who have had gambling problems. I mean, historically mm-hmm. in spring training, less in Arizona, more in Florida, you know, when the game was over, everyone went to the track. Everyone started betting on horses. So there's always been a relationship between sports and gambling. I think there's this, you know, interesting historical correlation between gambling at spring training. And then, of course, the complex where Salt River Fields is built is next door to a brand new casino. So I actually tried on a couple of different vices and struggles for Jason for a while. You know, it was a romantic entanglement. I thought about a substance abuse issue, but didn't spend too much time with that. But then when I realized, you know, the physical place this story is set, there's a casino across the street. It, you know, felt like a 2x4 in the head. It's like, well, of course. And I think it also speaks to, you know, athletic performance. You know, we want these athletes to be profoundly competitive, to not have an off switch. All of the things that make you a good athlete also make you, not all of them, but many of the mm-hmm. things that make you a good athlete make you susceptible to these kinds of addictions.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Emily Nemens. She's the author of The Cactus League. Let's talk for a moment, if we could, about an aspect of your novel that I found really interesting, especially given the fact that this novel is written by a 21st century woman. You've got some things in this novel that aren't exactly the best examples of feminist behavior or the feminist movement. I'd like you to talk about the cleat chasers in your novel. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's something that we all have heard about. I have no way of knowing even whether it is common, let's say. But I wonder if maybe you could tell us how you got there and what role it plays in your novel.
You know, I was interested in narratives about women in baseball. I think, you know, there's another baseball book that came out this year by Gish Jen. It's dystopian and a bit surreal. And this 15-year-old girl has the best arm in some future flooded version of America. A League of Their Own, of course, is another version where women are playing sport. And again, sort of with the same motivation of saying that's great, but that's been done, I wanted to think about women in the sport as it currently is. So that was one motivation, was to think, you know, less about idealization and more about a slightly unflinching, a little bit unflattering, but a more honest portrait of how and where women fit into the current ecosystem of sports mm-hmm. culture.
So tell us what a cleat chaser is.
Right. Well, the cleat chaser, these women, one of the chapters is follows Tamara Roland, who, you know, had been married to a minor leaguer, got divorced, and then came out to Arizona, and she waits for the spring and sort of moves around all the different stadiums and, you know, goes out with a different athlete every spring. So that is what a cleat chaser is in my book. You know, I was very much thinking of Bull Durham and sort of the archetype that was the Susan Sarandon character there, which, you know, was a really compelling portrait, but I wanted to add some dimensionality and make my cleat chaser, my baseball Annie, a bit more complicated. You know, this woman, Tamara, has a life all year round. She has interests outside of the stadium. She's kind of a savant in terms of a baseball fan. She loves the game, knows everything about it, and also, you know, brings a lot of empathy and support to these athletes when they need it. And I don't think that is ever really a part of the conversation about cleat chasers. You know, it's a money thing, it's a power thing, it's a prestige thing. But the idea that these men often do need the support of a woman, and, you know, it's a two-way street. I wanted to point that out in that chapter.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. So there is mention of Kirby Puckett in this novel. And I just was curious as to, first of all, I learned something about the fact that he died as young as he did. And
that's a real tragedy, yeah.
Yeah, and I really had forgotten that. I suppose at one point I knew it. How do you randomly pick Kirby out of baseball history? Or any other prominent major leaguer that you may have mentioned in here? Did you always have maybe a soft spot in your heart for Kirby's performances, or maybe your dad helped you out here?
No, I love watching Kirby Puckett when I was a little girl. I thought he was great. You know, in terms of that chapter, I was thinking about specifically tragedy of athletes and other people dying very young. You know, Lou Gehrig is discussed, and Kirby Puckett was the second youngest person to die, having been inducted into the Hall of Fame. I think I got that right. But you know, there is a list of looking at baseball players that were taken, Hall of Famers who were taken too young, and the character who is reckoning with his own mortality. I wanted him to have connections to both of those athletes, as, you know, a little bit of a breadcrumb or a signpost to readers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny that it's this fluffy little dog named Kirby Puckett. Like, that's a bit of a joke. But on the other hand, you know, I very seriously wanted to reference that, that very hard and sad thing of these men who passed away much too soon.
You also do an excellent job of providing insight into the life of a player's wife, and players' wives take center stage at one point in your book. Do they really have lingerie parties, Emily?
I don't know. I think they must. You know, I watched for that one. There was a lot of research. I watched, you know, there was a Baseball Wives TV show. There was a Basketball Wives TV show. You know, there's a hashtag for it, the WAGs, the Wives and Girlfriends. So, you know, that one I was imagining quite a bit, but I also was able to sort of internalize the dynamic and a lot of the conversations and imagine what a day in the life or a season in the life of those women might be like.
Right, right. Well, and it's not fair of me to ask that question with our listeners out there not having read the book. But there is a lingerie party for players' wives in the book, and I just kind of wondered where that fits into the real life. But certainly seems to make some sense. There's no doubt about that. So if we could talk for a moment about the woman who sells popcorn and beer. I thought that was a really difficult part of the book, in the sense that it shows not all the people who show up for those spring training games every year are in the same great shape financially that most of the fans are.
Right. Yeah, I saw something early in my research, you know, that a bartender makes more during spring training than he does all summer, which makes sense, of course. You know, a million people show up to watch practice baseball. And of course, the summer is, you know, uncomfortably hot. And just, but to be so seasonal about an economy is an interesting sort of lodged itself in my head, and thinking about what that means for all different sorts of communities. You know, it's the golf club where you can't get a tea time, but it's also the concession workers who have very seasonal work. You know, maybe they're working for the football season at ASU, and then there's no work at all for 2 months, and then they've got a steady gig for 6 weeks. And, you know, they're waiting for spring training too. I think the commonality across all these characters is everyone's waiting for spring training and has hopes for the season. For some people, it's performance, you know, making the team, getting through all of those cut days. But for people like Alex's mom, it's just a paycheck, you know, and it's a relatively steady paycheck, where 2 months of stability is more than no months of stability. And I didn't want to bang anyone over the head with it, but thinking about, you know, if we're talking about the mega millionaires of the Los Angeles Lions and Jason's $200 million contract, it felt important to point out that there's also someone making minimum wage to support that economy and that ecosystem, and having them both in the conversation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I came away from it thinking I'm going to lay bigger and heavier tips next time I have anybody wait on me at a ballpark. So that's, I think, a good thing. Emily, yeah. We've run out of time, but I do want to close by thanking you for writing the Cactus League, and tell you that I thought the greatest compliment that could be given you about this book, and I don't remember where I read it, but somebody said, if anybody thinks this is just a baseball book, it's not. It's a book about life. It's stories of people struggling in life and the challenges they have. And so I want I certainly want our listeners to remember that even if you're not a baseball fan, this is a great read. And I thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you for having me, Bob.
Next week, an encore presentation of our talk with Lindsay Hilsum about her book, In Extremis, the thrilling account of war correspondent Marie Colvin's epic life and tragic death based on exclusive access to her diaries. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.